Our next case this morning is Rule v. Hardy, case number 12-2515. Mr. Zajac.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. This case presents attorney errors of a constitutional magnitude. This case presents a trial counsel whose defense theory was that the centerpiece of the prosecution's case, Denise Shubat, was a liar who was covering for her own involvement in this murder by implicating Mr. Rule. Now, there was plenty of evidence to substantiate this defense theory. The problem was, defense counsel Edward Edens didn't present it to the jury. His failure to do so was entirely unreasonable, and it was prejudicial. The story the jury heard was that Shubat lied to police for 3 months, but then she finally came clean and implicated Mr. Rule. What the jury didn't hear was that the two detectives that were hearing this story for the first time and observing Ms. Shubat, they thought she was being deceptive. They observed deceptive body language and nervousness. The jury also heard that the reason she lied to police for those 3 months was that because she was afraid of the co-defendant, Mr. Serio. But the jury didn't hear evidence that, contrary to this alleged fear, she was actually at two small gatherings in the very week after the shooting, including 2 days after the shooting and the very night of Neubauer's wake. The jury also would have heard, but didn't because of Eden's errors, that Scott Owens, who had known Ms. Shubat for 12 years, thought she was a dishonest person. Now, these two errors involving the police and these witnesses, all four witnesses, they fit together, along with all the other numerous errors that are described at length in our briefs. They fit together like a puzzle. And once all the pieces are together and you take a step back, you see a picture of constitutionally deficient representation. Or, to put it in language that this court has used in cases where it is found that multiple errors have prejudiced a defendant, there was a massive evidence that Rule could have presented, and that's the Washington case. And there is a pattern of ineffective assistance, and that's the Goodman case. Now, it's important to bear in mind, when considering the combined effect of all these errors, the cautioning of the Supreme Court in the Strickland case. The court said there that a verdict weakly supported by the evidence is more likely to be affected by attorney errors than one that has strong record support. And this case is just one of those cases that Strickland was contemplating when it said this.
Is it fair to characterize the basic thrust of the Strickland claim here is that the defense attorney didn't present extra impeachment evidence? Because there was plenty of impeachment evidence of the star witness, Ms. Shubat.
There was some. I know the state argues that there was a lot of impeachment evidence, but I would disagree as to the value of that impeachment evidence, especially compared to the impeachment evidence that he didn't present.
The officers who took her statement when she came clean, as you said earlier in describing the prosecution theory of the case, they would not have been able to testify to her state of mind. They would only have been able to testify to what she manifested to them in terms of her degree of nervousness. And that could easily be explained away by she was, you know, coming clean from a pattern of lies that she had just given rather than she was now telling a lie, is the theory that you suggest should have been presented. And that was the theory that was presented. I'm not sure the testimony about her degree of nervousness when she gave that statement to the officers would have added much.
That may be true in terms of nervousness, but you also have to consider the word that Detective Lucci specifically used was deception.
But he can't testify to that. That's not admissible. He can't testify to her state of mind. He can't interpret it. Well, none of that would have been admissible at trial. He would have been able to say that she showed these indications of nervousness. I don't know what they were. I don't remember. Was she crying? Was she...
Well, indications of nervousness and indications of deception. I don't think he would have said that she was necessarily being deceptive, but he could say, based on my experience...
No, he couldn't testify to that. He's not a forensic psychiatrist. Right.
Is there anything inconsistent with her being lying about her own involvement and telling the truth about Mr. Rule's involvement as well? That seems to me Mr. Rule's, you know, driving back on the morning with the admitted the person that also was involved, and he's also there buying the bullets, as I understand it. There's plenty of evidence that he's involved. Her lying about whether she knew what they were up to and wanted them to do it or not doesn't mean he wasn't involved.
Well, absolutely, Your Honor, but the thing is, and this leads to the other thrust, there's the lack of impeachment evidence, and the other thrust is the failure to establish the defense theory entirely. Now, to speak to Your Honor's point about Schubert's involvement and whether there's evidence that she wasn't telling the truth, Mr. Eden's failures amounted to a failure to establish her motive and her opportunity. And on the motive point, there was evidence that she was in an abusive relationship with Mr. Neubauer. Now, the jury heard none of this. What the jury heard, and this is a trial transcript, page 577 and 78, is that they had a wonderful relationship. And at page 593, there were no problems in the relationship. Now, Jennifer Schoblom would have testified to personally hearing Neubauer's verbal abuse. She also would have testified to observing suspicious bruises on Schubert.
But the jury heard that Schubert heard Ruhl and Serio talking about killing Neubauer several times before the actual event occurred, never passed it on to him. I mean, that's pretty good impeachment evidence of her, isn't it?
It's decent impeachment evidence, Your Honor, but that was explained away because she was saying, oh, I thought they were joking. And she said she didn't take them seriously until the very moment right before when Serio allegedly blocked her from going outside.
And then she doesn't report it for 4 months. Or three
and she
months.
Doesn't report it out of alleged fear, which, again, there was evidence that she wasn't afraid, and she was actually hanging out with them two nights later.
It really sounds like her credibility was not very strong all the way through the case.
I think that for every point of credibility, the state was able to, and the prosecution was able to, present evidence at least plausibly explaining it, and Eden's failed to present evidence that would have debunked it. And his failure to do so completely derailed his trial theory. And especially, returning to the motive point, especially, there's evidence of abuse, of the verbal abuse. Scott Owens would have testified that he heard that Schubert had complained to him of Neubauer getting physical with her. And more importantly, Marcy McIntosh would have let me back up. In the police reports, Schubert admitted to telling Serio that Neubauer was being physically abusive and that it would be better if Neubauer were gone. And now, if you take a look at how that establishes motive, it establishes motive not just for Schubert to be involved, but even more motive for Serio. It's not just that Serio wanted to have her for herself. He wanted to rescue her from this abusive relationship. And this is actually consistent with the excluded testimony of Marcy McIntosh, who said when Serio admitted to personally shooting Neubauer himself to her, he also said that he was saving Denise Schubert and her daughter from Neubauer. And that's at separate appendix, page 165. And none of this testimony about the motive was presented to the jury. All they heard, as I said, was that this was a wonderful relationship. So if you're a juror in Ronald Rule's case, and you sit back and you're asked to weigh this defense theory that Schubert was involved, and you have an absolute failure to establish motive, they're not going to accept it. And that's why all these errors were prejudicial. And additionally, not only did he fail to establish this motive, he completely failed to establish the opportunity of Schubert to participate in this crime. Now, the defense theory was that Schubert was the person who helped Serio transport the body up to the fairgrounds. There was also evidence that he failed to rebut that a voicemail was placed from Schubert's landline at 2:48 a.m. Now, he could have used phone records to show that there was no evidence that this phone call took place from Schubert's landline. Now, there's no evidence that it took place from definitively from somewhere else. The phone records are silent on this. But the jury didn't know that. All the jury heard was, oh, she was home. And there was no evidence to the contrary. And especially once we talked about Schubert's credibility being a little suspect but still justifiable. If you add in the credibility points and you tell the jury that you don't have to trust her that she was home, you see the pieces fitting together of this puzzle.
No, the phone records wouldn't tell either way.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have in the records Schubert's landline's phone records. All we have are Neubauer's, and because she left the voicemail, because of the way the records work, it only shows like one specific number every time a voicemail is left. So they're silent.
It doesn't show the originating number, just if it goes to voicemail.
Anyway. Yeah, it just shows the voicemail number.
Okay, so she could have called from a landline. We just don't know.
We don't know. She could have called from anywhere. But because he failed to establish that she wasn't home at 2:48 because he didn't put in this evidence, he had to then show it was possible for her to be home at 2:48 to make this call. And the way to do that was through a drive time expert.
But there's no drive time expert that would have testified she couldn't have been home at that, or would have been home under that. I thought, wasn't there evidence introduced by this by the state
so
that she had she taken the route, had she helped him dispose of the body in Kenosha County and come back, she wouldn't have made it home in time to make the call, right?
That's right, Your Honor. The state did provide an expert. And the expert also admitted to different variables on the map. Eden said in his opening statement, I'm going to produce evidence that this is possible. But he didn't. And because of that, under this court's precedent, that's a prejudicial point because he didn't follow through on his opening statement, promise that he's going to produce evidence that is possible for her to be home. And because he told Mr. Rule that he would get an expert, he told the jury he would get an expert, and then he didn't get an expert, and that is the only way to establish that
didn't
this drive time
was... Didn't he actually hire an expert and just didn't introduce the testimony?
The record isn't clear. All we know is that as of the opening statement, he intended to put on some testimony. I don't... If he didn't have in mind still having an expert, I don't know how he was intending to show, have people testify that this drive time was possible. Because... The state's witness wasn't going to do it. And
how important was that once the evidence was introduced, though, by the officer who stopped Serial and Rule coming back from that morning, early morning? How important was it wasn't the whole point of that evidence to show that Shubat had gone with Serial, but that evidence of the traffic stop now showed that your client was with him at the time, was Serial at the time?
I disagree that the evidence of them getting stopped several hours after the shooting shows that my client was with him at the time of the shooting. I mean, it's circumstantial that it's possible, but I don't think that establishes it. And if you're going to have a defense theory that it was Shubat in the car, you have to provide opportunity because the jury had no reason to believe, and in fact they had evidence to not believe this defense theory. You need to provide that expert witness testimony to at least have a plausible defense theory. And under this circuit's precedent, the failure to provide expert witness testimony necessary to sustain your defense theory is ineffective assistance of counsel. And that's exactly what happened in this case. It appears that I'm in my rebuttal time, so I would
thank you.
Reserve.
Ms. O'Connell.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to begin by correcting a misrepresentation of the record. My opposing counsel has stated that the only evidence that was before the jury was that this was a perfect relationship between Neubauer and Shubat. And in fact, counsel put on a witness himself as part of the defense theory, Sandra Morton, who testified that it was not a great relationship between the two of them. And this is that document 42-4 at 85-87. So that's just incorrect. I think we agree, both sides, that there's a lot of ambiguities here in what the evidence shows counsel did or what the value of certain testimony would be. However, the presumption is that counsel rendered reasonable, competent assistance. And any ambiguities mean that petitioner has failed to overcome that presumption. And just to clarify, there was an assertion in the reply brief that said that the presumption doesn't apply, basically, at the investigative stage. That there's a burden on the state to first produce evidence that there was an adequate investigation. But in a case that we cited in our brief, Burt versus Titlow, dealt with this precise issue and said that this presumption applies at every stage. And in that case, too, the allegation was an insufficient investigation. The Supreme Court said, you don't have any evidence that says that he didn't investigate, which means that you haven't satisfied your burden on the deficiency prong. And additionally, just to show how unreasonable some of these allegations are that counsel failed to investigate, petitioner conceded in his reply brief at page 4 that there was evidence at least that counsel read a police report. Well, it just as a matter of sort of common sense, if an attorney is reading a single report, he's going to go through the entire file. And I think it's clear from his cross-examination of Schubert in particular that he was very familiar with the police investigation, and in particular with her statements to police and the areas in which they conflicted and changed over time. Petitioner's burden is also to demonstrate prejudice. I would agree with the characterization here that the this was a significantly impeached witness. And the allegation is that it was prejudicial that counsel failed to do more. However, there are several points where petitioner cites evidence. Each of those, however, is really insignificant on its own. I mean, especially the cell phone records, which actually corroborate Schubert's testimony that she left this message. There's no evidence that she didn't place it from this phone call. So those, in judging prejudice, this court should consider what the jury knew about Schubert. What impeachment did they have in front of them when they were making the determination that her testimony implicating petitioner was credible? And there's a significant amount, and it's really not rebutted in any significant way by the additional pieces of evidence that petitioner has pointed to. Oh, and I did want to correct also the allegation that there were detectives who would have testified that Schubert showed outward signs of being deceptive in her interviews. It's clear from both of the reports that she was viewed as deceptive at a very specific point in the interview, which is when she was addressing her own involvement. When she was discussing the fact that Sirio had brought this up before, he'd done so multiple times, this was the area where the detectives thought maybe there's more. Maybe she was part of the planning, and this is part of her deception. So, in fact, I mean, at the Supplemental Appendix 102, where they note the deceptiveness, they make very clear it should be noted that during this portion of the interview, i.e., when addressing Schubert's own involvement, she showed signs of deception. Now, I'm not sure to what extent that really impeaches her testimony because, as the court has pointed out, just because Schubert may have been more involved than she admitted to being doesn't mean that she lied about the fact that petitioner was part of this plan and that it was him that she heard in the parking lot shooting through the car window and then coming inside the bar and himself saying to Sirio, I mean, could there be more evidence of a conspiracy? We need to get rid of the body. That was something that was before the court that clearly showed that the two of these were involved in a crime together, and that sort of goes against petitioner's theory that it was only through hearsay testimony that the jury heard of the conspiracy. In fact, there was direct eyewitness testimony of what petitioner did and where he was that established the conspiracy, and then once that was established, then the evidence of what Sirio told petitioner became admissible as co-conspirator statements. And an additional point I'd like to make on that is in the reply brief, petitioner raises a new argument with respect to the co-conspirator statements. He said in his opening brief that this was an unreasonable determination of fact under 2254D2 to find that there was a conspiracy. We established that he didn't satisfy that standard. And then in the reply brief, he says, well, actually, it's more appropriately viewed as a misapplication of Crawford. Well, at this point in the litigation, that's waived. That's something that should have been in his opening brief. And at this point, it's really too late to argue. But I would also note that Crawford itself says that it does not apply to testimonial statements. It applies to testimonial hearsay, but excluded from within that class are co-conspirator statements. This is Crawford on its face. It doesn't apply under the circumstances here. And unless the court has further questions, we would ask that you affirm the district court's judgment.
Thank you. Mr. Zajac, you've got 3 minutes left.
Thank you. Just to respond to a couple of points that the state made, the state brought up Sandra Morton. Sandra Morton was a clearly biased witness. The prosecution was able to elicit testimony that she visited Mr. Rule in prison 20-odd times and that they talked about her testimony about a dozen times. So under cases like Mosley, the fact that there are additional witnesses who are better witnesses for the same point, especially when we're talking about a crucial credibility motive point, especially when you consider the defense theory that Schubert was involved, these extra witnesses would not have been cumulative. It wouldn't have been unreasonable to call them. And because the jury had no reason to trust someone who was clearly biased in favor of Mr. Rule, I don't think that this court should view the fact that counsel put on Sandra Morton, which was, by the way, basically his only witness, as somehow meeting his constitutional requirements. Additionally, the state brought up the fact that petitioner has not met, or we have not met, our burden of establishing what exactly investigation occurred and how that was unreasonable. The fact is there's never been a hearing in this case, and that's one of the reliefs we're asking for, is for this court, if it's not comfortable with what exactly was investigated or what these witnesses would have said, remand it down to the district court. It's well within this court's power to do so, and we encourage the court to do that. If there's any reservation when you step back and look at this puzzle I'm talking about, if you take a step back and you say, I just don't know what he did and what the basis of the decision was, I think the record's clear enough that there's no reasonable basis for doing any of these things, failing to get an expert, failing to introduce the phone records, failing to bring these witnesses that said she wasn't afraid of Sario.
The question is whether it would have made any difference, you know, whether it was prejudicial here, because I mean, even assuming that there were gaps in trial counsel's performance, you know, whether even assuming best case scenario, the additional investigation and witnesses would have testified as your client would like them to, would it have made any difference, or would it have just been cumulative impeachment?
I think the fact that there was a complete failure to establish motive and opportunity that sunk the entire defense theory, I think there's a reasonable probability if you can establish motive in the minds of the jury, at least a feasible one.
Well, that just casts doubt on her own degree of involvement. It doesn't exculpate the defendant.
Well, that's partially true, but if you think of, okay, the part...
So I guess the theory, your theory is supposedly she was along for the ride with this dumping of the body in Wisconsin.
Well, one of the pieces of the puzzle we haven't talked about is the excluded testimony of Marcy McIntosh, who would have said that Sario personally admitted to shooting. Now, the fact that Sario personally admitted to shooting Mr. Rule, and the fact that Schubert said otherwise, I think creates the reasonable probability of the jury not buying anything she says. Because if she's up there testifying that all this stuff went on, there's no reason to believe a word she said if Sario himself is admitting to personally shooting him. And I think there's important points to think about under the McIntosh point and why the Illinois appellate court was unreasonable in its determination and in its application of this Supreme Court precedent under Chambers. If you look at the Chambers case, the Illinois court completely disregarded, did not consider the additional confession that Sario made to Amanda Barbaro. And the fact that there are separate independent confessions, just as there was in Chambers, where the Supreme Court said that independent confessions corroborate each other, this makes this case even more like that, and the failure to consider this additional confession, which corroborated the original one, it's an unreasonable application of that case. And then it's not like there's no additional evidence. In this case, there was Sario personally owned a gun. Sario actually had a motive, unlike Rule. This was testimony that the jury absolutely needed to hear, and the fact that Edward Eden showed up at trial or to the pretrial hearing with no corroborating witnesses and then attempted the very later that day to say, we need to have another hearing so I can present my corroborating evidence. That's unreasonable performance. That's prejudicial, and that's one of those pieces that fit into the puzzle. When you take a step back, they're all consistent. So,
all right, thank you.
So if there's no further questions, I ask this court.
I don't think so. Our thanks to both counsel and Mr. Zajac. I believe you were appointed by the court on this case, and you have the thanks of the court for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your client and in service to the court. Thank you.